your heaters on. I don't know if you want it on.
I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:19 on Thursday, February 19th, and we're here in room 120 of the Alaska State Capitol. Please silence cell phones for today's hearing. Representatives present include Representative St. Clair, Representative Holland, Vice Chair Story, Representative Himshute stepped out very briefly. She will be joining us momentarily. And myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Cecilia Miller. Our moderator from the Juneau LIO is Susan Quigley. And our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you all for helping us today. Today's agenda, we just have one item, a presentation that was prepared in accordance with House Bill 66 passed in 2024 on Alaska Native incarceration rates. As a reminder, we only have 1 hour for today's hearing as we have a hard stop at 4:15 p.m. for the Department of Administration subcommittee. And our presenters also have to go to Senate State Affairs today. So with that, we can go ahead and start our presentation. For members' information, we specifically are looking at the report that came about with the passage of House Bill 66 in 2024. And Section 64 of that omnibus crime bill instructed the Department of Corrections to contract with a statewide Alaska Native organization on investigating the root causes of high rates of incarceration for Alaska Native peoples and providing recommendations to alleviate this issue. So today's presentation is being led by the Alaska Federation of Native Folks, contracted to complete the report, and includes testimony from those who helped to write the report. Our testifiers today include Kendra Kloster from AFN, who is in the room with us, Brad Myrstall from UAF, who is also in the room with us, Charlene Apok, who is on the advisory team for the report and is the executive director for the Data for Indigenous Justice, who is joining us on Teams, Rick Garcia, who is on the advisory team for the report and is the policy director for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, also joining us on Teams, Fiona Rowles from the UAF Center for Alaska Native Health Research, as well as Katie Sueva, who is from the UAF Center for Alaska Native Health Research, joining us on Teams, and for Katie Sueva in the room with us. And it's my understanding that the individuals will each present a portion of the slideshow. I'd like to welcome folks to ask questions during the presentation, but because of our time constraint, we're going to do our best to get through all of the slides and to stay on schedule, so we may end up holding questions till the end as time allows. I'd just like to note also that Representative McCabe has just joined us. And please welcome our presenters. If you could put your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sandy Martinson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Institutions with the Department of Corrections. As you stated, Chair, DOC was provided funding to partner with AFN to launch a study examining the factors contributing to the disproportionate incarceration rate of Alaska Natives in the state's correctional system. DOC fully supported the efforts and took a hands-off approach to ensure integrity for the study. Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson and I are available for any department-specific questions. Now I'd like to turn this over to Kendra Kloster, lead for AFN.
Thank you very much. Sorry I didn't add you in my introductions.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Hello, good afternoon. Kendra Kloster, Government Affairs Director at the Alaska Federation of Natives. And I'm Katie.
My name is Dr. Katie Cueva. I'm an associate professor at the Center for Alaska Native Health Research.
And so we'll just get going. I know we are kind of time constrained, and we've got our team online as well. So to meet the team, you have met folks with the Department of Corrections, Alaska Federation of Natives, myself, University of Alaska Fairbanks. Katie and Fiona helped and with a number of folks with this report, plus the University of Alaska Anchorage and an advisory team, Dr. Charlene Upbuck, Rick Haskins-Darcia, Alex Cleghorn, and Doreen Schenkenberger all participated in helping write and put together this report, along with, you're going to hear much more, a deep dive into this, but I wanted you to understand like who helped put this amazing report together and the work that went into this. Okay, a little bit of background, just so we kind of understand and ground ourselves in what's happening here. Alaska Native people have experienced disproportionality of high rates of incarceration, reflecting kind of a deep systemic inequalities. While Alaska Native people make up anywhere from 14 to 19% of the population here, the incarceration rate is about 44%. The disparities really are looking, you need to look back, and I want to understand this, that this is a long-term, this is an issue that began generations before. If we're looking at historical trauma, inadequate access, and all the different things that have happened, if we want to look back to areas of boarding school era and all the different things that inequalities that Alaska Native people have faced going back. And so this isn't something that has just, you know, popped up. We think about, I want to think about this, and I'm going to frame it in this way first. We're very centered in the culture and who we are, and by our elders, by our children, by our dance, and by our language. This grounds us in who we are. Understand that generations ago, they told us not to dance, took our language away, and put our kids in boarding schools, and brought in disease into our communities. This set us down a path of a very different path of what it would have been. And so these aren't things that are just coming up. Alaska Native people are very strong. We've lived through a lot and are very resilient people. And so I just want to ground us in that and understanding of what we're talking about today. And that this criminal justice system that we're coming to, and just understanding this background that we're coming to right now as we dive into this report and thinking about all the things that we're coming from and that have really happened to how we're living and how we are. So, yes. So overall, the recidivism rate has declined over the past decade, but Alaska Native people continue to have the highest recidivism rate. As looking at the Department of Corrections information from 2025, reinforcing intergenerational trauma, imposing on high social and financial costs to the state. The majority of these individuals who returned to prison were reincarcerated due to probation and parole violations.
Maybe just one thing to add here. So, incarceration rates and recidivism rates also vary across time and by different geographic locations, which tells us that it's not an intractable challenge, that it's something that some communities or regions are doing in a way that is more proportional than others. So there's lessons to be learned.
And if you could just, if we switch between the presenters, if you could just put your name on the record again as we switch back and forth.
Sure. I'm Katie Cueva.
Thank you.
And so Kendra, just coming back to me. So reducing these disparities, it's not only a matter of justice and cost effectiveness, but a pathway to healthier, safer, more resilient communities throughout Alaska. And as Chair Carrick stated, in 2024, the Alaska legislature passed House Bill 66, which put in this directive for the Department of Corrections to work with Alaska Native Organization, so the Alaska Federation of Natives, to work on a report to really look at and understand the high rates of Alaska Natives incarcerated. And this, I'm not going to read through all of this, but essentially this is the language that was put into House Bill 66 so you can understand the pieces that we were directed to be looking at. Restorative justice programs, looking at intervening earlier with at-risk youth, early mental health diagnosis, low-income housing, misuse treatment options, job training mentoring programs, digital training, and then number 8 is looking to identify federal programs and funding that we could utilize. And then we kind of put in a number 9 because we, as we went through this process of learning other things. And as stated, these are the individuals and the kind of process that we went through, who was involved, the Department of Corrections, University of Alaska Anchorage, analyzed the data from the Department of Corrections, UAF, Center for Alaska Native Health, helped within doing a literature review, interviews and surveys, and then we hosted a community listening session. And I know in the interest of time, and we put out the report, so a lot of you can read this, so I'm not going to read every piece of the slide, otherwise I could be here a very long time. But I just kind of want to highlight pieces of this so we can, and then we can answer questions kind of at the end. So through this, looking at number one, expand restorative justice and tribal court programs. Alaska has a strong history of alternative courts, tribal courts, therapeutic courts, which really focus on restorative justice programs. And this is something that really came out in our interviews, our surveys, and through our literature reviews and just conversations when thinking of things like tribal courts or community accountability models, diversion programs. It's looking at a way where it's just you're not automatically being able to, you know, put someone in jail. That's not the purpose of what is that restorative justice of making that person and that community whole. So the example I can think of when talking with individuals is if I'm going to use an example that was shared with me. Some youth had maybe an indiscretions, and so they let's say vandalized. And so rather than going and just, we're going to go and we're going to charge you with misdemeanors or felonies, we're going to go back and we're going to bring you in and you're going to be in front of your aunties and your uncles. And let me tell you what, that's a little bit more scary if you're going to go in front of a tribal court with your aunties and your uncles. And we're going to talk to you about this and we're going to see what happened and you're going to go back and you're going to restore all those individuals of what happened. You're going to talk to them and you're going to restore what happened. And that could be fixing what you broke and vandalized. Maybe that's going to fish for that family, whatever that might be. And so in that model, you restore your community. You're held accountable in that way and loved up at the same time. The individuals that went through that did not go back and reoffend. And so those are the examples of something that I learned about through tribal courts. And so those are kind of different models that was talked about in here. And I'm going to ask Katie if she wanted to add
sure.
on to that.
Sure, Dr. Katie Cueva. So some recommendations as well. So there are tribal courts, but not in every community in Alaska. And so expanding the number of communities that have tribal courts is a recommendation, as well as expanding the purview of their cases. So at this point, tribal courts are doing amazing things, but only have jurisdiction over a small number or type of cases, sometimes just custody cases or just domestic violence. So being able to expand that. Also, a number of tribal courts are operating with very little to no funding. So working in collaboration or cooperation with state agencies to ensure that they have jurisdiction and funding support to be able to do the work that they're doing so well.
If we could actually pause right here and go to Representative Hemshute.
Thanks, through the chair. I think my question might have been answered, but I was just thinking, what is the scope of offenses that could be included in the jurisdiction of a tribal court? I know a lot of family law takes place there, but I'm guessing probably not up to the level of felony, but misdemeanor like shoplifting. What are your recommendations around that?
I'm also going to call on Rick Garcia, who's also been working on tribal courts and tribal court judge who's online with us.
And I'll just add also, is it in statute on the state side that determines what a tribal court can hear? It's an agreement between the state and the tribes, right? For what cases they can take.
Yeah, so I'm going to call Rick to answer all those questions for us.
Sounds good. Mr. Garcia, if you heard those questions and want to weigh in.
Yes, thank you. Rick Haskins Garcia speaking through the chair. Thank you for the question. The types of cases that tribes are able to hear are largely determined by the tribe itself. And I want to kind of separate out civil cases versus criminal cases. All tribes in Alaska currently have the ability to have full civil and criminal jurisdiction over their own tribal citizens or citizens of another tribe, either in Alaska or downstates. When we talk about non-Native offenders on the criminal side, the Violence Against Women Act 2022 reauthorization created a pathway, a pilot program for Alaska tribes to begin exercising criminal jurisdiction over non-Native offenders who commit crimes in Alaska Native villages. That is a process currently that is underway, and it requires approval from the Attorney General with the Department of Justice. We have a number of tribes that are moving towards criminal jurisdiction, but currently there is no tribe in Alaska that is exercising criminal jurisdiction over non-Native offenders.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. I want to be sure I'm understanding this correctly. The tribal court's jurisdiction, since we don't have Indian country, is based on the citizenship of the individual in a tribe, not on where the issue happened.
Through the chair, that is correct. It is a citizen or a person-based jurisdiction, except when we start talking about criminal jurisdiction, there is a requirement that the crime occur in the Alaska Native village.
Okay, thanks.
I think we can go ahead and continue.
So I'm going to move over to, again, Kendra Kloster. Moving over to our next recommendation, looking at early intervention for at-risk youth. Here, through a lot of our research, surveys, interviews, and all the different pieces looking at investing in early childhood, youth mental health screening, supporting parents at free and low-cost culturally grounded parenting support, funding programs to strengthen cultural identity, language subsistence, land connection, were all pieces that came very emphasized through this, of really understanding how we're supporting at a very early age. So those were, sorry, it's been a very long day. looking at our programs and cultural programs ahead of time before they're entering into the correction systems. So if we're looking at cultural programming within our school system, for example, that was one of the recommendations, encouraging our school districts to have working with our tribes to put culturally based programming into our schools. That is connecting with our students, understanding, because that's a huge piece, of, I think, Native and for non-Native children, to really understand the place that you live, building that connection and understanding our language and how we hunt and fish. That's building that connection with within our lands. And that is a piece of us that's just such an important part of that land connection. And that's focused on that early intervention piece that has come up very often. So strengthening support and funding for those youth programs, for that community and cultural-based connections. And I just want to point out, a lot of these quotes that we're putting here is taken directly from the interviews of the individuals who participated in this study.
And Dr. Katie Cueva, one of the things about early interventions is to begin at the earliest phases possible. Kind of the earlier, the better. So thinking of things like access to free or low-cost prenatal care or parenting education, the prevention of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder have some of the highest returns on investment, so are the cheapest per outcome and tend to have the greatest and most effective outcome because they happen at that age and can set young people on a good path.
Again, Kendra Kloster, looking at number three, mental health. Early intervention for childhood trauma can prevent juvenile justice involvement, providing steps for trauma-engaged care, better involvement in communities, tribes, and businesses, and supporting student outcomes. So looking at expanding early mental health screenings, diagnosis, treatment, especially looking for our children and young adults. Expanding Medicaid and other reimbursement pathways to support Alaska Native-led models. and requiring culturally responsive training for DOC, probation, parole, courts, and healthcare staff. I actually really love this quote that was brought up, is just really understanding that I think emphasized what I had said even the previous recommendations, is grounding that to place. Boating, camping, hiking, four-wheeling, spending time with family and grandkids and my daughters, just being able to be in their life, present in their community, cooking at Moose, having them come over, and just, again, a quote that you can continue reading, but it's something bigger. It's building this community is part of understanding and building our community and taking care of our kids and having our elders and our children as building this culturally based within our schools, within our tribes, and within our communities, as being kind of one of those number one things that we want to talk about for mental health. And so we're not going down that path toward even getting into the incarceration system. So what are we doing to prevent to even getting in there first, in the first place?
We have, if we could pause here, we have a question from Representative Himshute.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just reminded, towards the end of last session, I pulled a citation and my friend from Big Lake helped me keep my composure because it was for Chuck Miller, who was a culture bearer in Sitka, and he passed at 51, and he was supposed to be the keeper of the culture for the next generation, and we lost him. So there's a gap. But Chuck always said, culture is medicine. And as he was going through treatment and unsuccessfully, he never lost sight of that. Like, he came to Celebration and some of his last days were spent here at Celebration. So anyway, my question though is on the expand Medicaid and other reimbursement pathways to support Alaska Native-led service models. Can you make that connection for me? How can we use Medicaid to support, like, what is it we're doing there? Is that just for healthcare, or is there something more I'm not recognizing?
Dr. Katie Cueva, through the chair, I might be able to help clarify. So at this point, there are sort of cultural service models as well as Western therapeutic telemedicine kind of talk therapy models. So part of that is having Alaskan Native cultural models that are reimbursable. So they're something that an individual could receive, especially someone that doesn't have the funds to pay for a Alaska Native cultural-led intervention. So something that looks like talking circles, looks like culture talks from elders, looks like getting out on the land with an elder, looks like that connection to community and culture, which I think the individual you referenced is exactly right. A number of our interview participants talked about that culture as being very healing.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And just another reminder, just make sure we're putting our names on the record between presenters. You both have similar voices, so I just want to make it easier for our record staff.
Sorry, that was Katie Cueva.
Thank you. Please continue.
Kinder Cluster, moving to recommendation number 4 on housing. I could probably spend a lot of time when it comes to housing, as this comes up pretty often in a lot of my conversations, anything from public safety to no matter what the topic is housing is often brought up from teachers as well. And so this was a big topic for us to address, is increasing housing to reduce homelessness and justice contact. So for individuals that are coming out of incarceration and into reentry, is having reentry housing with integrated services, including substance misuse treatment, mental health, job support, can reduce recidivism and increase follow-up. So just having that, if you're coming out, being able to have assistance in finding affordable housing in the community that you're coming out in. Another piece that came in is allowing remote probation and parole supervision so individuals can live where housing exists. And this is a conversation that I think that will come up in multiple different pieces of these recommendations. So if you have an individual that's from maybe a remote community, they were in Anchorage, incarcerated in Anchorage, and they're released on probation or parole, and they then are coming out and they're in Anchorage, but that's not their home. However, they might have probation or parole, that is requiring them to stay in Anchorage of checking with their parole officer or probation officer, though housing is becoming an issue and they want to move back home, but within their parole and probation is not allowing them to do so. So that was that has come up in multiple areas. So removing barriers that are removing those different barriers that are coming up is one of the areas that we looked at in multiple different areas. So making sure that we're providing support so tenants have, so people have access to housing when coming out, and making sure that there are programs and then integrated programs as well, so they can get services along with housing and affordable housing. Moving to recommendations for number 5, increasing access to alcohol and drug misuse treatment. Substance misuse treatment for Alaska Native peoples requires culturally responsive, culturally centered models that integrate Alaska Native cultural ways of life with the Western-based evidence practices. So partnerships with tribal communities, researchers, and health systems is essential. Increasing tribal treatment resources and funding culturally responsive programming. As an Alaska Native person, for me, and I think a lot of people, you know, that I talk to within our communities, when I think of things that are, I think of hunting and fishing and living on our land, these are pieces that are integrated into our life. It's dance, it's beating, it's who we are as people. Those cannot be, those have to be part of our healing process. That has to be part of the treatment process. And that's part of our community-based and Native-led programs. And these are what need to be integrated into these kind of treatment programs. This is what is going to be successful for us and for Native people. We can't, not having this kind of, it's not a one-size-fits-all type of thing of having a Western-based model. And so really understanding that of what is culturally based that is going to work for Alaska Native people. And I really want to emphasize that.
Dr. Katie Cueva, another point, one of the things that we found in our literature review was providing substance misuse treatment to folks while they are incarcerated. It's one of the cheapest and most effective ways to address substance misuse among the population that interacts with the Justice Department. As you're probably aware, so long wait times for substance misuse treatment are certainly a challenge. And thinking about those early interventions, especially thinking about individuals that are pregnant. And so when they're ready to receive treatment and there's no space available, then we inflict that trauma again on the next generation.
And Kendra Kloster, looking at recommendations number 6, strengthening job training and mentoring. Career training during incarceration combined with structured reentry support, strongly reduce recidivism. Programs like Alaska Reentry Coalitions providing job skills and placement assistance, and increasing Alaska Native representation in criminal justice fields. So some of the recommended actions that came out, creating education and career pathways for Alaska Native judges, attorneys, probation officers, correctional staff, clinicians, and reentry specialists. Supporting mentorship programs using credible messengers, and expand education, job training, apprenticeship programs during incarceration and reentry. The interview, one of the interviews that we have, a quote that we have up here. They need to start hiring more Native correctional officers and probation officers. They need to start hiring more lawyers, Native attorneys that can either act as public defenders or prosecutor's office, and they need more Native judges. I think being able to, you know, see Native people in these spaces and allowing more job training in many different ways, I think is really important to understand. And looking at, we have many opportunities when we think of, you know, Zoom and online things that are now much more available as what can we do to be expanding those job training programs to be available.
And Dr. Katie Cueva, this point about hiring more Alaska Native people into criminal justice occupations, as well as other occupations that we've been talking about, such as behavioral health or healthcare, or early childhood education, would address a number of the barriers to having thriving individuals who are free of the participation in the criminal justice system, because it helps to address racism, helps to address workforce development, helps to address several of these social dimensions that we've been cited.
I have a question on that workforce slide. I know public safety in Alaska has actually sort of been, I think in a lot of ways, a model for trying to help build a workforce that is more diverse, has more Alaska Native people in it, has more people from communities working as village public safety officers, et cetera. What are some of the, I guess, specific options for increasing some of the career pathways and interest in law and justice professions? And it's difficult because we don't have a law school in Alaska. So it's, I'm just wondering, like, are there organizations that are working to increase this representation outside of AFN, and what helps to support that?
Okay. Kendra Kloster, a couple of the programs I've seen and I've actually been learning more about is there's a young Native man that started a program around doing a technology, for example, being one thing, and how to train different individuals. So one of the issues that we have as far as, you know, workforce in maybe parts of rural Alaska is if you have like an IT issue. There's not a lot of IT specialists maybe across the state. And so he created a company where he can bring you in for a few days. We're going to train you on IT programs. You can go back to your village, and then there's additional training that you can do online. And then whenever a project comes up, he's able to call them and say, this is happening. Can you go and fulfill this work order? And there has been some more kind of work programming done through this specific company. And so I have heard of individuals taking on kind of a more creative ways. So that's one example that I've heard of. I think there's other examples through programs through our universities. And I know that there's other, you know, apprenticeship programs that people have been working on. And definitely not to say that I think there's definitely room for improvement. The one of the barriers, I would say, you know, we have a lot of online programs, but our communities in rural Alaska lack broadband and that kind of access. So I would say for a lot of the things that recommendations when it comes to being able to have access to things like telehealth, for example, and workforce development, you have to look at how we're going to be able to fix the access to broadband. There are services and things that you have available or remote jobs and that rural communities and people there could do. But if you don't have access to broadband or fast internet, we're not going to have that. So I would say that's something that needs to be fixed in rural Alaska for us to be able to access those opportunities.
And then I have a follow-up and there's a couple other questions too, but I know one of the challenges, at least in some communities, for having more homegrown VPSOs, for example, is the idea that you're going to then be performing police duties in a community where you know all of the people. And we've talked about tribal courts before being really amazing at working with the community members and like really reducing crime. But do we run into some of the same challenges as we do in public safety, where maybe folks don't want to become a prosecuting attorney when they know they might be prosecuting their friends and family members potentially? Is that ever cited as a challenge for folks wanting to get into the fields?
Representative Carrick, I think that's, you know, that's definitely probably a challenge. I would agree with that, but I still think that there's individuals that'd be interested maybe in doing that, even those that want to be a VPSO. And some, I think some individuals have been VPSOs have maybe gone to other communities as well. If they didn't want to be in their community, they would have gone to another community. But it's, you know, Alaska is a big yet small place.
Yeah.
And Dr. Katie Cueva, I think Chair Carrick, that's a great point. And I think, you know, there's similar issues in other professions. The thing about the community health aid program, you know, similar, do you want, you know, your auntie to come in and potentially have an STI? Or, you know, there's challenges when working with our friends and family that are unique, but it hasn't stopped people from taking part in those roles, even in their own communities. I also think just in terms of programs, we have other translatable models. Like, we do not have a law school, but we don't have a medical school either. We have WAMI. So there's partnerships. So there's an opportunity to create an additional sort of partnership in the law field or other criminal justice fields as well. And there's also opportunities to do things online, you know, if there is access for people in rural Alaska.
Thank you for those insights. It's really helpful. I have Vice Chair Story and then Representative Himshute.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you both for being here with us today and for the recommendations. And my question has to do with, and I know we're talking about partnerships, but do we have a sort of a baseline about what we have as far as, I think, when I think about reentry as an example, like what do we have as a baseline for training offered in our different correctional facilities? We just added tablets last year, and I see that we've got Ms. Dumont here from the department. It'd be nice to have a baseline of what we could build up or where we're at to build out for the recommendations. I don't think a baseline exists, but to know we needed more with your recommendations, you probably knew we did not have a lot. And I know that we do have some training programs, and when we're looking at incarcerated individuals, for an example, it does a baseline exist anywhere that we know what we offer, what we may need to build from?
Do you want to answer that, or anyone? DOC.
Oh, through the chair,
I guess
I might. Yeah, sure. I was just wondering, and I know I mentioned Ms. Dumont, but I wasn't meaning to put her on the spot. I was just wondering if you did get a baseline from the department of what we offer in our different correctional facilities as far as reentry and what we have right now, what we need to strengthen, what we might need to grow into.
So, Kendra Kloster, Representative Story through the chair. That wasn't necessarily a piece of what we looked at through this report. I would say that there's a lot of pieces to be looking at. This just covered really looking at, we didn't have that really specific baseline for reentry. It was just really looking at the specific pieces put in through House Bill 66 of what we could look at for these recommendations. And I'll say that we have... in doing this report, I have a lot of follow-ups that really came out of this of thinking that I have a lot of follow-up things that have come out that I would like to continue to work on, because there was a lot of questions, a lot of ideas, and a lot of things that have come out that I think that we're going to work on with UAF and DOC and others on how we continue to grow on this report. So that is something that we can continue to look into and get back with you.
And this is Dr. Katie Cueva, so Vice Chair Story through the chair. I do think you're right. Well, Kendra is right that was beyond the scope of this particular project, but that for implementing any of these recommendations, I think that there's some evaluation that would be quite useful to know where we're at and where we end up going and what is working well in implementing those recommendations, so we know if they're working well and what could be strengthened.
Thank you. We'll go to Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, through the chair. I have to go back one slide, and I think I'm going to have the exact same answer, so we don't need to spend a lot of time on it. But my question has to do with the first bullet point on recommendations: provide substance misuse diagnosis and treatment options for all incarcerated persons. Similar question: what is our baseline? What are we offering now? And I thought, having been working intimately with the system, you might have those numbers, but it is beyond the scope of what you're asked to do. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And really appreciate kind of what this study covered. And also, I think it's good to recognize what it didn't cover and kind of like what we need to do next as a state. So those questions are really good to kind of highlight what some of the next steps might be. We do have just about 15 minutes left. And so I might ask all of us to just hold questions. And we would love to welcome back our presenters at some time to continue talking about this subject. And so if you have additional insights on the report, I'd like to just give you the last 15 minutes to just share some of those insights. And then I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee and give it to the presenters and get the answers back to everybody.
Sounds good. I would just say, and I know we have some folks online that I would like to be able to allow them the opportunity to. You have the full report and feel free, you know, can read through that. There's a lot of information in there. I'll say real quickly, number 7 was improving digital skills and access, which I think we've already kind of touched on. And number 8 is the sustainable funding. And there's lots of information on funding. And the piece I'm going to address about this is one of the things we were asked to address is looking at all the different funding that is available, but also understand that accessing funding is not easy, especially going through federal grants. It requires a lot of work on our tribe's part. It's going through that process of applying for the funding to be able to get the funding and staying on top of all of this, like one-time grant funding. So that information is in there, but I think part of it is really understanding how the state and the federal government and tribes can be working together to be able to maximize the funding, to be able to support all these different recommendations and programs. So I do want to pass it to some folks online to offer any feedback. I know we had the Brad, the University of Alaska, who did really worked on like the baseline data report, but also Dr. Charlene Uphuck, who was part of our advisory team, and Rick Haskins-Garcia, who was online as well, who spoke earlier. Give them an opportunity to say anything, just kind of wrap us up at the for the report.
Can folks hear me?
We can. Please okay. Go ahead.
Yes, just a quick correction for the record. My name is Brad Merstall. I am not in the room. I am joining you via Teams. For the record, I am the director of the Alaska Justice Information Center, and we contracted with AFN to do an analysis of booking records of DOC to help understand the inputs. And I'll give you a little bit of background. I'll go really quickly. The summary of our work is slides 17, 18, and 19 in your packets. I won't read the slides at you. I'll just try to give you the highlights so that everybody has an opportunity to chime in. A few quick points I'd like to make that I think are really important for people who may not be familiar with the criminal justice system and often are surprised to learn a few things. And so I want to emphasize first that everybody understand that the Department of Corrections is a receiving institution. It exerts very little direct control over the composition of the population and its custody. I think that's really important to understand that the DOC receives people, and it's a very rare circumstance where somebody is not allowed through the Sally port. Point two that I want to make just as a preliminary item, it's important to note that Alaska is one of only 6 states that operates a unified correctional system. And this becomes critically important for understanding compositional characteristics of the system and disparities that we see in it. I would highlight that DOC facilities function as both jails and prisons, and many of them do that simultaneously. Jails and prisons are not the same. And in most jurisdictions, in the United States, they are wholly separate entities, and they're governed by separate governmental entities. So, for example, jails in most places are largely pretrial facilities, and they house short-term misdemeanor detention functions as well. And so that's very different from a prison, which is a post-conviction facility reserved for felons and typically for longer-term custody. Jails have continuous flow in and out on a day-to-day basis, even though there are some fairly consistent temporal patterns over time. So these are just important things to understand between jails and prisons in general, and to understand that Alaska is relatively unique, and that it combines these functions all under the Alaska Department of Corrections and some of the 13 institutions across the state that are run by DOC perform both of these functions simultaneously. I say these things just to develop or sort of establish a baseline understanding that the racial composition of ADOC's institutions must keep these features of the how DOC operates in mind. And in particular, as my presentation will draw your attention to, that is DOC's jail function. We have to pay very close attention to it because it represents that point at which the inputs, the system's inputs, enter into the picture. So why focus on entry into DOC? And how did we go about doing that? In collaboration with the department, we looked at booking records of a cohort of 12,700 unique individuals who were booked into DOC in one calendar year. And we looked at their first booking event and then picked that apart in great detail. The big takeaway of that is that, as Kendra addressed earlier in her presentation, roughly 42 to 44% of all ADOC inmates are Alaska Native or American Indian. When we look at the inputs, what we find is 43% are Alaska Native or American Indian. Now, I want to highlight that this is not simply a replication of the snapshot data with which this committee and many people are aware. It points attention to the critical importance of what's coming through the door, and it at the risk of overstating things, almost the full amount of the disparity is accounted for by who comes through the door. This becomes critically important when you think about policy and practice. I'm going to overstate things here a little bit, but try to make the point for simplicity's sake. On any given day, DOC could empty, and none of those people will come back, but the next day the disparity would be replicated. When you're in flow, when everything is baked in at the point of entry, it directs our attention to upstream. And so one of the themes of my analysis is upstream causes, downstream consequences. And of course, the recommendations that are included in the report highlight many of those upstream interventions that can help solve the riddle of who comes through the door. In general, what I would say is the focus from a policy perspective, I'm not going to point to any specific levers, but perhaps direct the committee's attention to some things to think about, is crime prevention. And it sounds trite, but it's absolutely essential. Without focusing on the prevention of crime, it's a bit of folly to think about what might be done inside the walls of DOC institutions to change the overall picture. So the inputs have to be addressed to produce any sort of real, meaningful, and lasting change. And crime prevention is a key factor, though not the sole factor. And what I would, if I may, suggest to the committee is think of this from a public health approach. And again, Katie and Kendra have done a good job already of sort of framing it, but just as a heuristic, I think it's really important to think about what you mean by prevention. And if you think about it in this standard public health model sort of way, is there's primary prevention, there's secondary prevention, and there's tertiary prevention. And it's important to be clear when you're talking about prevention what you mean. Primary prevention is essentially avoiding crime, keeping crime from occurring at all. But you need to think about what the resource implications would be for that. And it's also important to think about what the policy response is. In general, and this is a bit of an oversimplification, I would say primary prevention speaks to broader social, economic, health policy domains, whereas criminal justice policy really lives in the world of secondary and tertiary prevention. And by secondary prevention, I'm referring to things here like early detection and early intervention practices, and tertiary prevention, harm reduction and mitigation strategies like recidivism reduction plans and restorative justice practices. So there is a large appendix in the report that you have at your disposal. I would welcome any questions the committee might have at a later date. Kendra has my contact information. And with that, I thank you for your time and I'll turn it over to the next speaker. Thank you.
And I believe that's Dr. Charlene Napok. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll give her the last word and then we have to head over to the Senate.
Hi. So we have, I'm so sorry. I apologize that we only have about 5 minutes before you all have to be at another committee, but would love to get your perspective as well.
Thank you so much, through the chair. This is Dr. Charlene Abuck, and there is so much information that you all have been presented. These teams have done a wonderful job providing comprehensive research with a lot of nuance and consideration. You know, I arrive here as an Alaska Native woman whose mother was largely incarcerated for most of my life. And so these ripple effects that we see through the ways that it impacts our communities is very much something that is lived and felt as we do this work. And I guess if I had any final remarks to say about this is that we know that this is not new. You can see from the data and the research that it has been happening over time. And now is really the time to invest in tribal-led solutions that are presented here today in this report. Koyana.
Koyana, thank you very much for presenting and to all of our presenters for being here. Just want to reiterate that folks on the committee, if you'd like the responses from any of our presenters back to the whole committee, feel free to forward them through our office. And if possible, it'd be really wonderful to have our presenters come back at a later date and talk more about these subjects in general. But thank you all for being here today. I'll leave our presenters to have the last word.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to present this and look forward to having more in-depth conversations about really what the next steps are.
Thank you. So with that, House State Affairs is going to conclude for today. Our next meeting is on Saturday this weekend. I just want to remind our committee members that you can feel free to Teams into this meeting if you need to. That does count for a quorum, and we don't intend to move any legislation on Saturday. We have three first hearings on the following bills. We have House Joint Resolution 22 on congressional term limits by Representative Tomaszewski, House Joint Resolution 23 on the governor submitting a balanced budget from Representative Underwood, and then two related House Bill 290 and House Concurrent Resolution 10 related issues on uniform rules change and statutory change on delivery of resolutions from Representative Holland. And we will, again, be taking public testimony at that meeting and having first hearings, but please let me know if you are able to attend in person versus on Teams. And with that, House State Affairs is adjourned for today at 4:13 p.m.